Hello, my name is Marie Tighe and I'm from the National Office of Human Rights and Equality Policy, which is part of the HSE National Quality Improvement Team. Today is the first of our Spotlight on Human Rights and Equality podcast series. Today I'm joined by Mervyn Taylor, who is the outgoing CEO of Sage Advocacy, which is an organisation that has been providing services in circumstances where people are often vulnerable or have to depend on others, and there's a need to ensure that their rights, their freedoms and their dignity is promoted and protected. So, Mervyn, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
I am a simple man from a small village with no pub in Wicklow. I've been developing Sage Advocacy since November 2013, and then formally from the 1st of April 2014. And I'll be leaving at the end of September. And in that period, I hope we have developed a fairly sound base for support and advocacy for older people. We've then expanded out to include other vulnerable adults. And more recently, we've been asked to be involved in advocacy for healthcare patients.
So what or who is Sage Advocacy and how did it come about and what does it actually do?
Well, the origins of Sage Advocacy go back to quite some time, to 15 years, to Lees Cross. The scandal of Lees Cross. Sometime after that, there was discussions within the HSE about the need to develop, and with the NGO sector, to develop a number of initiatives. A key person in that would have been Anne Harris, late of your parish, who would have developed a volunteer-based model purely for nursing homes. What happened over subsequent years was that without sufficient, commitment of resources. It became clear that a volunteer-only organisation could not really work effectively. And I think by the time it then moved for a while to Third Age, but the key issue was that I think people like Greg Price and Anne recognised the need for to put it on a more solid footing, and they worked with the Atlantic Philanthropies, who agreed to part fund it for a 3-year period. So the work that I started in November 2013 was effectively trying to prepare the ground with Atlantic Philanthropies. And then from the 1st of April, I was appointed to develop the service. And it is now an independent company funded through the HSE at the moment.
And what brought you into this kind of work and what gave you an interest in coming into this type of work, Mervyn?
Well, I suppose we're all, to a certain extent, prisoners of our own history. My father developed MS before I was born. So I've been a carer. Well, my mother was enormous amount of the care, but I did a small amount. My elder sister would have done a lot, but from an early age, I would have known what caring at home was. I would be aware of the difficulties of, you can't maintain somebody at home all the time and the lack of alternatives. I've also worked in residential care in London and was involved in, I developed the MS care centre, respite care centre at Rathgar. So those are just some of the interests, but I think, I've always had an interest in developing the whole continuum of care and support that is needed for older people. Quite apart from my personal interest in it and experience, as I mentioned, Lees Cross was in 2005, but there was also Horus Attracta in 2000. and 15, I think it was, that scandal. And then there was Portlaoise, and there was also in the background a range of other advocacy services which were kind of very poorly funded. So the discussions after Ars Attracta was that greater work was needed in the area of systemic advocacy for people with intellectual disabilities. But also then there was the issue of Portlaoise, and arising out of that, there was the question of, well, how do we develop patient advocacy? And then the HSC asked Sage Advocacy, would it take responsibility for the services that have been provided heretofore by Patient Focus? So Sage Advocacy developed from a volunteer base of concern after Lee's Cross, focused entirely on nursing homes, to something which is now available for mainly older people, but also healthcare patients and vulnerable adults. In that category, I would include the person with MS who's in their 50s, who's been forced into a place they don't want to be for lack of other supports. I would think about somebody with a stroke who is not being allowed leave hospital because there's a very definite view of what services are available or are required. And there is every chance that person stays in that hospital for a long, long time without some intervention. So these are all kind of things that have been coming our way. And SAGE is kind of, one of its things is its adaptability and the need to kind of be flexible, and above all, need to be quite, we have a phrase that we collaborate where possible, but we challenge where necessary. And I think one of the things about SAGE is, despite the fact that it is funded through the HSC, is that the HSC and ourselves have learnt to live with each other and to work with each other, notwithstanding that there would have been huge champions like Greg Price and Dan Harris, but also there would be other areas of the HSC that would be, some people would be suspicious of the idea of independent advocates.
And why do you think is advocacy needed? Is it not the role of the family?
Well, you see, independent advocates are independent of family, the service provider and systems interests. Certainly family members and health and social care professionals do actually advocate to a considerable extent for their patients, residents, clients, whatever the name that is relevant in a particular context. But there can be a limit to what they can do because they are bound within their own organization. And I've noticed two things in the last few years. One is the extent to which health and social care professionals increasingly come to SAGE looking to make sure that the person has an independent view. And I have to say that most of the people who do that are very fair-minded by virtue of the fact that they come to us. There's a very small section, and they belong to a very controlling, one might almost say reactionary group, who believe that the idea that somebody who is vulnerable could speak for themselves or could have their own will and preference taken into account rather than what the professional thinks is in their best interests. There's a small coterie of those, and they can be enormously damaging to the liberty and the rights and the dignity of vulnerable people because they want what is most suitable to the system without having any regard for what the person themselves might want. And that can end up in extreme situations whereby the guards are being called and the guards are being asked to return people to hospital. And in one particular situation I'm aware of, I have to say that members of An Garda Síochána showed greater appreciation of the rights of citizens than the healthcare professionals involved. So there are tensions involved in our work, and there's a cultural change that is occurring, and we're part of that change.
How does advocacy as a service work, Mervyn? Could you talk us through that?
Sure. One of the key things is that people are can refer themselves, but we don't have that many self-referrals. A lot of our referrals are actually from, in the case of nursing homes, they're from nursing home staff. They can often be from relatives. They can be health and social care professionals within hospitals, or they can be people in the community. So our referrals come from a wide range of sources, but we have moved beyond working solely with nursing homes. In fact, now if you combine our community work with clients in the community and in acute hospitals, we do way over a half. So it's a large minority of our work would be with nursing homes. It's fair to say that most referrals come from people who are close to the person, but not the person themselves. And I think that's something that is, there's been a change, a welcome change. As I said earlier, that there's a growing cohort of health and social care professionals who are seeing the need for the person to have another voice. It's particularly the case where you have, say, families where there's divisions within the family, and the person themselves, the vulnerable person, is actually being tossed and turned. They're the subject of a sort of an inter-family war, and it often gets very, very bitter, and people can refuse mediation. And I think, you know, we have even seen some cases of what one might call extraordinary rendition, whereby people have been moved by one section of a family without any notification to others, to another part of the country, where it's almost impossible for somebody, unless they've got a lot of means, to travel on any regular basis. So these are the sort of things that occur. But the referrals are now coming from a very broad range of sources. We're now getting, I noticed, more referrals from public representatives, and we would have an increasing dialogue with them, because obviously they come in contact with the public a lot. But we would see, we're seeing some interesting patterns that have been coming up in the last while. I don't think it's entirely related to COVID, but it's a strange coincidence.
Yes.
That in the period, things closed down a lot during COVID.
Yes.
In some ways, I mean, we can talk about that in a moment. But we're noticing some strange phenomena, like more issues about alleged like sexual assaults within congregated care settings by older people, on older people, perhaps by others, and people with a history of being sexual abusers who are now in residential care, and for whom there are issues, you know, there are historical issues, and there may even be current concerns. And these raise new, you know, it's not the traditional view of the person that's in a nursing home or a congregated care setting, as we would call them. It's raising really big challenges for the staff in those facilities. And I think it's one of the things that one has to look out for is there's always a new phenomenon coming as each generation, as it were, ages. A section of that generation will be in congregated care and will reflect the problems and indeed the things that were perpetrated earlier on in their lives.
And how has your service been able to help in those kind of situations, Mervyn? Could you tell us a little bit more about it? You know, how has the role of an advocate been of benefit in those kind of situations?
Well, in Nigeria, I mean, there's a lot of situations where SAGE Advocacy's role is very much, I suppose we're a touch point for a lot of people. There would be a lot of places that would make contact with where they just want, they have a situation and then they're pretty okay at handling, they've got a sense of how they want to handle it, but they want really to bounce the options or the approach around and get some support. That reflects very well on the people who contact us, that they want to make sure that there's no stone unturned. And a lot of our work in those situations is really trying to kind of, in supporting those people, sometimes getting them information, talking through the options, but also sometimes bringing things forward that they themselves are, their hands are tied. So there are things that are big systemic issues that it's going to take a while to address. But I would think specifically in relation to some of the concerns that I would just raised about new trends that we're noticing. There are issues like sexual behavior or historical legal issues. There's issues about controlling behavior, as some people would see it, challenging behavior, that some places are just not really equipped, or that there's a major amount of work needed to assist them in identifying the best way forward. We would see on a quite regular basis that the solution, particularly in the private sector, is to move somebody on. If somebody is upset or their behavior issues, rather than trying to engage with what is the issue here, it's
yes.
Very often it can be try and find a chemical, you know, medical solution, a medicine solution, rather than kind of thinking what else is going on here. And it's going to be increasingly become an issue that congregated care settings have been used like mini institutions to deal with all sorts of problems. And I think COVID has exposed some of these fault lines, that there are people who are extremely vulnerable, they're very frail, they have multiple conditions, and they're in effect in, they need considerable medical care.
Yes.
And they deserve it because of their condition. Mm-hmm. Now, they're effectively in the last couple of years of their lives, so end-of-life care is involved as well. And they're in a situation where they're, you could almost say that they're almost in a community hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they don't have all the facilities of, the, there isn't proper clinical governance, and that's one of the big issues of the moment. And alongside that, you can have people who can have a life expectation of, you know, maybe 30, 40 years in some cases, because there's no other facility, they're being pushed, effectively deprived of their liberty. And that becomes very, very clear in situations where somebody is locked down. In effect, we are seeing for some people, I mean, I'm aware of people who happily sat out the worst of the COVID watching box sets in bed. But there were others who were absolutely frightened out of their mind watching people, very often strangers, as there was a high turnover of staff and sometimes a complete turnover of staff, appearing in strange garb. There were people who were not having access to anybody for many months. But there was, they were thinking, this is the rest of my life for decades.
Mm.
In situations like that, looked at from that person's perspective, you're not looking anymore at care. You have to think in terms of, from the perspective of custody.
So did Sage have any role to play in helping people or advocating during those times, Mervyn?
Sure. Initially, I recall that a lot of the, you know, our people in the field, some of our volunteers would be older, and a lot of people were grounded, so to speak, for mm-hmm. health reasons and protection. But we got a lot of, I know I've never experienced so many calls about people being caught in the wrong place, you know, that they were trying to get here before everything was locked down, or as lockdown was happening.
Yeah.
They didn't want to be where they were. An awful lot of issues about trying to get to the next stage, but effectively being blocked because of lockdown. I'm thinking of somebody, for example, who, you know, we would spend a lot of time trying to support people who didn't want to be in long-term care. But I'm thinking also of a particular person who, and a few others like him, who had nobody else at home, become increasingly incapable of living at home, and were, you know, real dangers to themselves, and mm-hmm. had the conversations and were beginning to realize they needed something, but they couldn't get into a nursing home because they hadn't been tested. Because they hadn't got any signs of COVID, they weren't on any priority list at the time for being tested. So you got all of these kind of interpretations of guidance
challenges, yeah,
and you know, hard rules very often make for difficult exceptions or requests for exceptions. Mm-hmm. So we got a lot of those issues, and then I mean I've said this on RTE before, my abiding memory of the period, the worst period, was just that image of phones not being ringing and not being answered. We dealt with quite a number of places where families, and indeed some staff, were ringing us and trying to kind of find out what was happening in a particular facility, a congregated care facility. And in one case, we were contacted by somebody, and this is to illustrate the kind of level of concern and fear that could be created as a result of a major outbreak of COVID. Somebody had been transferred to a nursing home from an acute hospital, and a relative was trying to contact them, and I think over a period of 3 days couldn't get an answer. And we ourselves then tried, couldn't get an answer. And then eventually somebody picked up the phone, and then it was put down again. And then the relative actually visited the place, couldn't get an answer to the doorbell, and walked around and saw people in bed with their meal in front of them, mm-hmm. and was very concerned. Now, there's always two perspectives on that, but we were at that point where we were calling the guards, because it was mm-hmm. you know, from where we were. Now, thankfully, we were able to also contact HSE people who were involved, and to link things up. But that gives you an example of how fears spread, because people were hearing about, and in fact there were very large numbers of deaths in a number of nursing homes, but there were also fears being spread about because people couldn't get answers, and therefore stories of huge numbers of deaths were being circulated. And we found, then we went through a phase of dealing with quite a range of politicians who effectively were shroud waving. They were trying to find out, you know, which nursing home was the worst, had the worst casualties. Were, if you like, trying to kind of cash in on that. That kind of ended when one particular public representative named a nursing home as having a large number of deaths, and it turned out to be untrue.
But I suppose, just from talking about all of that, could you tell us more about how you could get, I mean, there's a lot of people in congregated settings that would find, you spoke about people who are vulnerable and might know how to do it. So how do people like that get advocacy, or how can you tell us how we can, I suppose, get advocates for these people?
Yes, I mean, the anybody who's ever concerned can get our contact details on sageadvocacy.ie. We have an 1850 number. Everything is on that website, sageadvocacy.ie, including a referral form. But we are available. Our 1850 number is available, which I hope you'll be able to put up at the end of your podcast. We will be available from, we can take calls from either answered or monitored from 8 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock at night. So if there's something really urgent, we can have somebody to visit a person, COVID restrictions taken account of, within 24 hours anywhere in the country. Now, thankfully, that degree of urgency doesn't happen too often, but it has happened and we've turned up. So people, most referrals come simply by there's a referral form, and it's a health and social care professional. There is a lot from families. If it's an advocacy case, we do insist that there's some form of referral, and there's the obvious issue of consent. Who's giving, who's looking for this advocacy? And then, of course, there are people who ring up on the information support service, sometimes via the 1850, sometimes just email in, and they simply want guidance. Occasionally, we receive considerable abuse from a family member who doesn't like the idea that we are actually advocating for their relative, because they feel they know what is best for that person. And that can be, that can create a lot of difficulties.
And could you tell me generally, are you well received, or tell us, are you well received in services, and how does it work out?
So I think I could say it's a curate's egg, in other words, good in places, but it's not.
Yes.
In fact, it is improving. The longer Sage is in business, the more it improves. That being said, we had yet another occasion recently where two members of our team were refused admission to a nursing home. In this case, we suspect it was at the request of a family member. We have cases where people supposedly sign documents rescinding their consent to us and being involved. In those situations, we have a absolute policy of going and asking, going to the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Yes.
And you find that the situation is, in those situations, it's usually, it can come, really what's happening is almost like coercive control. And I think that's where I think the need for deprivation of liberty, or let's put it another way, protection of liberty in places of care, legislation and safeguarding legislation becomes more important. We have three major pieces of legislation that we need. One of them is developed, it's passed, the Assisted Decision Making Capacity Act of 2015. 5 years later, the Decision Support Service is still not fully up and running. And it may be another couple of years before that happens. And I think that is actually disgraceful. And if that continues, it'll become the Indecision Support Service. I think related to following on from that, there is a need for very specific legislation to comply with human rights legislation to ensure that we protect the rights of people who are being considered for, if you like, care where there's an element of custody involved. And that protection of liberty in place of care legislation is, again, long overdue. There's consideration being given to it, but it's never really developed. Mm-hmm. We've never formally seen any heads of bill. The third piece of legislation that's really relevant, and then they come together as a suite, is there is a safeguarding bill from former Senator Colette Kelleher, put forward a bill which got all party support in 2017, safeguarding adults. Now, the Law Reform Commission have just completed a consultation on a framework for legislation on safeguarding. And we would really look forward to that report, in the months ahead. And if we can get legislation passed on that, I think it's a really good opportunity to develop, to bring things together. And if I may, I think it's time for one big bold move through that legislation, and that is to establish a national support and safeguarding authority, which would provide governance to the Decision Support Service, the Mental Health Commission, an independent safeguarding service which would come outside of the HSE, and to independent advocacy services such as SAGE Advocacy and the National Advocacy Service for People with Disabilities and others, so that we have, they are a continuum, and support and advocacy and safeguarding are all on a continuum, and there's a very close link between independent advocacy and safeguarding, so that we would see that legislation, particularly in safeguarding, is a vital piece of
legislation,
a building block for everybody for the future, because as the country ages, and there is a younger generation now that is actually in many ways disenfranchised, younger people are taking a lot of the hits as a result of COVID, but there's always a view, particularly in Ireland, that somebody has it and it's their inheritance and they want to get at it. And so this idea of coercive control, some of which we saw some evidence of during COVID, vast majority of people, you know, really broke their backs caring for relatives and made great sacrifices. But a small minority would have effectively used lockdown as a form of coercive control, but certainly undue influence. To encourage people to change a will or to make, you know, some arrangements which would be to mm-hmm. their benefit. And so there's a need for safeguarding legislation, and there will be more of this exploitation of vulnerable people, because in a way it's like, just like bicycles were more used during COVID, and then bicycles stealing rose, so also there's a lot more family engagement and caring at home for some people, but out of that arose opportunities for some effectively borderline criminal activity. So health and social care, I think there's going to be a need for greater a refocusing of safeguarding.
So, Mervyn, you spoke earlier about how you have moved, a lot of your work is involved in the acute hospitals and community sector. Could you walk me through maybe some of the cases that you're involved in those settings and what they relate to,
sure.
how the advocacy works in those kind of situations?
Yeah, I mean, the community settings can very often involve various groups of factions of a family. It can involve, you know, with different views as to what's the best way forward. without paying much attention to what it is that the person themselves wants, whether they have a brain injury following a car accident or a stroke or dementia. It can involve complex situations whereby neighbours are providing an awful lot of support, but the family members are actually getting the benefit, like maybe the carer's allowance, for example. And you know, these are they lead to very tense situations because there's a need for some straight talking in some of these situations. In acute hospitals, a big issue is trying to get people safely transferred to another place of care, which might be their own home, but because of the lack of services in the community. And I would stress this, the "and" word is important, and a lack of willingness by statutory services to engage or to even try and innovate and work out solutions on the ground. So we get a lot of problems like that. One of the interesting things about COVID, particularly recall one case where somebody was almost a year in an acute hospital and they couldn't get the home supports. Within 48 hours, they were at home. And there were people who actually said that things are better under COVID for them than they were before it. So, you know, you have these strange ironies that, you know, when it came to it, people could get the finger out and things did change. The question now is, can we maintain the good things that we did during that period and try and drop or not go back to the old ways, which
the
are,
old ways.
Let's see if we can make this as long drawn out as possible. I do think there's quite apart from a need for independent advocacy, there is a need within the wider health services for a greater emphasis on innovation, kind of almost a brokering approach, which is a lot of what we do, which is, can you consider another approach? You know,
what are you thinking of there? Could you talk us through some of your thoughts in relation to that when you talk about innovation?
Well, I mean, sometimes innovation is probably a grand word for just asking people to do a little bit of thinking
and
doing their job. I mean, I think of one person at the moment who is living full time under the care, you know, at the authority or direction of the High Court, who is in full term expensive residential care. And yet I have on file a note from public health nursing saying the man had social needs, but had no clinical needs. Now, those two things and the same system led somebody presumably elsewhere in the system to suggest that he needed full-time care, 24/7 care. So one part of that profession puts down in an email, there's only a social need, there's no clinical need.
Yes.
And another part of it, perhaps colleague says, no, they need 24/7. And in fact, really what you're seeing there is the system not being challenged and not willing to make any effort to do anything other than what suits them. And that is, it's easier to have somebody go into long-term care and then they're out of the reach of the HSC essentially, and they won't be a bother to them again. And I say these things very bluntly because this is one of the issues that is going to come up, is the need for culture change in the community care sphere. People will need to be challenged more and are going to be more challenged to find new approaches.
So what's your advice for staff listening to this interview today, Mervyn?
Well, I suppose the best advice I ever got was to post early for Christmas. my sense is that, you know, the vast majority of people in the HSE are incredibly well motivated. And most people get out of bed in the morning wanting to make a difference. However, the way we do things can actually create ways in which we're worn down and we just say, oh, look, this is the easy way. This is the line of least resistance. We're going to get less trouble internally. And I think it's to encourage people to be, it's asking a lot of times, but to be forever brave and to ask hard questions. One thing I would stress, and I've stressed it, I think there's the HSE Academy of Learning, we're running some courses there a couple of years ago, and in some of the engagements, we would have talked about the need for to develop a public interest role within the health and social care services. So that, for example, you can't have an independent advocate in every meeting about everything, but that you might actually develop a role where somebody was allocated, trained, etc. But it was an understood role that somebody would have a role to actually argue from a different perspective. We use the term multidisciplinary, like my father used to use pepper on his dinner. Which is to say an awful lot. We never talk about multi-perspective, which is to get the perspective of the actual provider. And sometimes that isn't always available or easily available, but it can be provided by a staff member asking questions. And developing that approach where it's accepted that somebody in a meeting or in a team actually argues, advocates on behalf of the person in the absence of an independent advocate.
Right.
I think that will be an important change. And I do sense there's a generation of people coming forward who are up for that.
And Mervyn, what would your wishes be for Sage as you leave now? And how it's going to grow going forward?
Sure. I mean, my main concern would be that there would be equity in funding for independent advocacy services. I'm conscious of the fact that at the moment we are funded by the HSE, and we're funded about half, we get about half of the funding that another advocacy service gets because it's under a different department. So I think government has to, and it will take its time, but it has to grasp the fact that independent advocacy is it's a practice that is, you know, its time has come, and it needs to be equitably and fairly funded. And my vision for Sage Advocacy is, and it's what has driven us all along, is to make it a team of people who are capable of tackling the most complex challenges faced by vulnerable adults, older people, and healthcare patients.
Yeah, yeah.
If you like, we are the ranger wing of independent advocacy services.
Any final thoughts?
I'd like there to be real engagement by this new government or whatever succeeds it with the agenda of the Assisted Decision Making Capacity Act, making sure that that is actually implemented without any more waste of time, that the decision support service is adequately resourced, that independent advocacy is equitably funded, and that we get the deprivation or the protection of liberty legislation and the safeguarding legislation. Above all, I think it would be nice in a couple of years' time to look at the establishment of a national support and safeguarding agency or authority, and to see safeguarding, advocacy, decision support and mental health commission under one governance, because essentially they are peas in a pod. And yes, I think that is something that I think is really worth striving for. The very final thing I would say is that it would be really good if we had, there's been a lot of talk about in the past about the reorganization, the constant reorganization within the HSE, and it's not up to this and it's not up to that. I think the HSE in many ways did itself proud during COVID. It had shortcomings, but I can't think of any organization. I just looked at a WHO review and I can't think of any other country, you know, that didn't have shortcomings. But we tend to look at the HSE as kind of something to kick. But I increasingly, as I leave Sage Advocacy and reflect on it, I would like to see an external international body like the OECD or some such organization actually look at what do we need in terms of a Department of Health. And I really would think that it's time to look at what the capacity and the capabilities of the Department of Health are and what we actually need. Or is it fit for purpose for the years ahead?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Mervyn, for that. And on behalf of the HSE and our office, would like to wish you a long and happy retirement. And thank you for all the work that you have done. And do you want to tell us where you're heading for?
Immediately, I'll be heading for Boyle.
Lovely. Lovely.
And beyond
well, enjoy.
Beyond that, we'll see. Thank you.
Well, good luck. And thank you very much, Mervyn. Thank you.
Thank you.